I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The Biden administration says the only way to reach peace between Israel and the Palestinians is a two-state solution. But to this Middle East expert, that's so far just talk.
I've not seen the policy moves to back up any of these efforts to advance a two-state solution.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In Washington, suddenly there's high anxiety about Russia's military capabilities in space.
What we think is a possibility is that this is some sort of space-based jammer. That is to say, a satellite that's placed in orbit that will jam or interfere with the broadcast signals of other satellites.
And in the competitive world of chess, a demand to stop the sexism.
It kind of is like a statement to the next generation, like, this is not going to continue. Like, the chess community has to make sure that we just don't allow it.
Those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli military today said it sent special forces into the main hospital in the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Witnesses at the Nasser Medical Complex described scenes of chaos, with smoke-filled corridors and the sounds of combat nearby.
Earlier this week, Israeli forces had ordered the hospital's evacuation, but many patients and medical staff stayed. Israeli officials said the troops who raided the facility were going after Hamas fighters and looking for the remains of Israeli hostages. Back here in the U.S., President Biden signed an executive order protecting thousands of Palestinian immigrants from deportation. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. I asked him what he thinks President Biden hoped to accomplish with that executive order.
He's essentially trying to shield any Palestinians who are under threat of deportation from actually being sent back, because it's a danger zone. It's a war zone in Gaza. It's very dangerous in the West Bank. So he's basically taking, I think, what I think are important but pretty modest steps to protect a small slice of Palestinians who may be here in America at the time.
President Biden has also imposed U.S. sanctions on Israeli settlers who've been accused of extremism. What does that mean exactly? And how unprecedented is that move by an American president?
It's quite unprecedented. What it does, it's modest in that it bans some travel from specific individuals and it imposes some costs. But critics of it say it doesn't do nearly enough to address the ongoing violence in the West Bank from Israeli settlers who have attacked Palestinians in some attacks that have been very deadly and quite inflammatory.
Just a note on this. I mean, this is an election year, and President Biden signed the executive order sanctioning settlers who violently attack Palestinians just before a campaign rally in Michigan, a swing state. Is that a coincidence?
Is it politically timed? Perhaps, but I think many people have overstated just how much this issue, the issue of the Gaza war, will animate the general election campaign versus other issues like immigration, like abortion, like the economic situation inside the United States. So it might matter in certain states like Michigan, but I think there's a tendency to overstate how much it actually does matter in domestic politics these days.
Well, compared to reaching an actual ceasefire, and we hear now that Israel says it's not going back to Cairo for further negotiations, these would seem to be sidebar actions, but the Biden administration is also talking once again about the importance about moving toward a two-state solution for Israel and Palestinians, which is something the current Israeli government does not support. What do you make of this? Do you see a newfound seriousness on the part of the U.S. to use its leverage with Israel on a two-state solution?
I've seen an increase in the rhetoric about U.S. positions, but I've not seen the policy moves to back up any of these efforts to advance a two-state solution. And what I don't see from the Biden administration as yet is a concerted effort to really step up in a major way its diplomatic engagement in a sustained way to achieve its goals. So yes, there's been nearly weekly visits by cabinet officials and top officials since the October 7th war broke out, but I don't see the game plan to actually use the full range of policy tools to achieve progress towards a two-state solution, in part because it's such a uphill climb.
Does that imply U.S. military support for Israel is going to be non-negotiable? And doesn't that simply empower Netanyahu more?
Like, there's a myth in some political circles that this issue matters a lot in terms of voting for ordinary voters. There's also a myth that the U.S. has a lot more leverage than perhaps it does with Israel, that if we simply threatened to hold off military aid and arms to Israel, that somehow this will magically get Israel's leaders to see the light and say, okay, we're going to implement a ceasefire, when Hamas itself also doesn't abide by a ceasefire and still holds on to hostages. Israel's leaders, I think, will respond to two main things: the security conditions they see in the region, and their country's being attacked every day, including from its northern border in Lebanon. It'll also respond to the domestic political pressures it faces inside. And there's a lot of support amongst Israelis, including Israeli Arabs, for the military course that the current government has mapped out. You know, the bigger question is, how does this all end? It's not clear to me that the current Israeli leadership has really answered that question. But right now, you know, I think that the Biden team still is very much in a reactive tactical mode, responding to events being driven by Israel, by Hamas, by Iran, rather than shaping them and driving them.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
Beyond U.S. policy in the Middle East, people there are grappling with how an existential fight between Hamas and Israel is changing their lives. That includes Adam Ben Shabbat. He's a Jewish Israeli citizen, and the Arab Jewish community where he grew up is going through its own identity crisis.
My name is Adam Ben Shabbat. I'm 23 years old. I'm doing video. I'm an editor and a cameraman, and I also have a YouTube channel. I live in a special village called Neve Shalom Wahd El Salam. It's a village that Arabs, Palestinians, and Jewish Israelis are living together and came in order to live together and to educate their kids in the same school, to teach both languages and to talk about the conflict and have a partnership together. I'm really attached to the idea, and I really believe in it. And like, my group of friends are Arab Palestinians, so I know their narrative pretty well, and they know mine. I grew up in a Zionist house. My father really pushed me to go to the military, because the first thing that we need is defense. I know all the thing that the Jewish people went through, then I understand it, that we need a house for the Jewish people from all the world to come here and to be safe. This is one part of me. But the other thing is that I know what this military is doing. And I think this war really brought me to a hard identity crisis. I was at my girlfriend's house, and we heard the sirens at 6:30 in the morning. Went to the shelter, of course, and I started seeing the videos on Telegram, and I just couldn't believe it. Of course, I thought it's fake news at first, and my initial reaction, it was to send those videos to my friends, my Arab friends in the village, because they are my friends, and also I want to see their reaction, because we are talking about the conflict every day, every time. Like, when we're sitting together in a bar and just having fun and chilling, we are talking about the conflict. You know, when you carry within yourself two narratives, it feels impossible. Like, every day I'm trying to find answers to those questions. And that the only thing that I came up with is, I want the other side, the Palestinian that lives with me, to have this identity crisis. And this is when I will know that we are partners. Also, I knew that what's going to be in Gaza will be hell. And this is so sad. We were really sad, because our whole dream just went down, and it will be really hard to rescue it. So now we are really trying to solve it between us and to go further and beyond. We are having meetings every week, trying to figure out what we are thinking and what we can stand behind together. And if we will solve it between ourselves, we can represent something to the outside. So this is now our time to show up and change, to evolve.
Adam Ben Shabbat shared his thoughts with Israel Story, a podcast about life in Israel.
Okay, even if you don't eat Indian food on the reg, you've probably had, and I bet you totally enjoyed, butter chicken. Creamy tomato sauce, subtle spices. What's there not to love?
It presses all the buttons that are needed to be pressed for a tasty meal.
That's food writer Mariam H. Reshi. But who exactly came up with butter chicken? That question is actually the subject of an ongoing lawsuit in India between restaurants. From Delhi, Sushmita Patak reports.
It's lunchtime at the high-end Daryaganj restaurant near Delhi's airport. Alok Ojha has just relished its most popular offering.
I had the original butter chicken.
The original butter chicken is a deep orange gravy made of hand-crushed ripe tomatoes, butter, and on-the-bone chicken, cooked in a traditional tandoor clay oven.
Typically, it tends to be very heavy, but it wasn't heavy, yet it was very, very tasteful, so I really enjoyed it.
The recipe dates back to India's independence, says Amit Bagga, the restaurant's CEO. He and his friend Raghav Jaggi opened Daryaganj in 2019 as a tribute to Jaggi's grandfather. Kundan Lal Jaggi came to Delhi after India's partition and opened a restaurant with two other partners. That's where he invented butter chicken, says Bagga.
The late 1940s, one day there were a lot of guests who came to the restaurant and Mr. Kundan Lal Jaggi was just about to shut the restaurant.
Jaggi wondered what to feed his customers. He had some leftover tandoori chicken, but it wasn't enough for everyone. Then someone gave him an idea.
Like, why don't you make a curry and put a tandoori chicken in it and serve it with the bread so everyone can have a hearty meal. So he went to the kitchen and, you know, he told the cooks to do this, that, whatever. And then he came back with the dish, which was now the butter chicken.
But Monish Gujral doesn't believe this story. He's the grandson of Jaggi's former business partner and namesake Kundan Lal Gujral. Gujral says butter chicken was invented by his grandfather.
It's unfair to attempt to steal legacy of Kundan Lal Gujral.
In the 1920s, Gujral says his grandfather used to run a restaurant called Moti Mahal in present-day Pakistan, where he introduced tandoori chicken, cooking the meat in clay ovens used for bread.
There were challenges to maintain the succulency of the kebab because they would dry off sitting by the tandoor. They would become inedible and inservable to the customers.
To avoid wasting food, Gujral says his grandfather put the chicken in a tomato curry. And butter chicken was born. When India was partitioned, Kundan Lal Gujral came to Delhi and started a new restaurant with fellow refugee Kundan Lal Jaggi. But butter chicken had long been invented, says Gujral.
As a partner, you can't claim a right to a invention that has been done much before.
Moti Mahal, the restaurant of the two Kundan Lals, quickly became one of Delhi's best. Top politicians and film stars were its patrons. Food writer Mariam H. Reshi remembers going there as a kid.
But I remember Kundan Lal Gujral, he used to walk around with a steel glass in his hand. He was the host of the restaurant because he knew everybody and their grandfathers most charming.
Jaggi left the business in 1992. There was no falling out between the two partners and both have since died. So they don't know their grandsons are feuding. Gujral's grandson now runs the Moti Mahal brand.
And as a custodian of the brand, I will fight tooth and nail to protect my family's legacy.
But the CEO of Daryaganj argues that the legacy is shared.
As far as legacy is concerned, that legacy of butter chicken remains with all the partners who started that restaurant together. No one can take away legacy from each other.
Now it's up to the Delhi High Court to decide. Moti Mahal is asking $240,000 in damages for copyright infringement. The CEO of Daryaganj calls the lawsuit misconceived and baseless. After sampling the butter chicken at Daryaganj, customer Alok Ojha is planning to go to Moti Mahal soon.
A couple of my colleagues, we are planning this whole thing and we'll see what our individual verdict is.
The court's verdict is at least a few months away. The next hearing is in May. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The White House today confirmed that Russia has obtained a troubling weapon that can be used in space. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said this afternoon.
And though Russia's pursuit of this particular capability is troubling, There is no immediate threat to anyone's safety. We are not talking about a weapon that can be used to attack human beings or cause physical destruction here on Earth.
Kirby said Russia has the capability for the weapon, but that it's not currently operational. This confirmation came from the White House after the head of the House Intelligence Committee yesterday urged the Biden administration to declassify the information. Prior to Kirby's confirmation, we spoke with Victoria Sampson, a space security expert with the Secure World Foundation in Washington, about what the military capability could be.
What we think is a possibility is that this is some sort of space-based jammer. That is to say, a satellite that's placed in orbit that will jam or interfere with the broadcast signals of other satellites, and that it has a nuclear power. There has been some reports of that over the past couple of years for Russia, so that's a possibility. I will say as well that Russia is not the only country that is thought to have space-based jammers. The United States and possibly China might have those as well. So just kind of contextualizing, this is not entirely new, but I think it's definitely worth keeping an eye on.
So important difference there, nuclear-powered space-based weaponry, not a nuclear weapon in space, is what would be most likely here.
We are thinking that if nuclear is somehow related, then it most likely is nuclear-powered as opposed to a nuclear detonation. I will point out, and again, I hope I don't sound naive by citing international law, but the 1967 Outer Space Treaty is very clear that weapons of mass destruction cannot be placed in orbit.
I'm going to ask you more about that treaty in just a second. First, I'm wondering, generally, what do we know about Russia's capabilities with regard to anti-satellite weaponry, you know, before the conversation this week?
They've got what we call co-orbital, where the satellites get into orbit and either blow up or interfere with the other satellites. They tested what we call a direct descent anti-satellite weapon. That's a ground-launched satellite interceptor that hits the target.
Like a missile that goes up into space and hits a target?
Exactly. They tested that numerous times and it actually hit the target in November 2021. It created about 1,800 pieces of trackable debris, about 300 of which are still around. And as well, the Russians are known to have jammers, both GPS and of communications satellites. They have some directed energy capabilities. And as we all find out, when they invaded Ukraine in February 2022, they launched a cyber attack against Viasat's ground terminals. So they absolutely definitely have cyber capabilities.
If the Kremlin is in fact working on a space weapon that has some sort of nuclear capability, what does that mean for the U.S.?
Specifically for the United States, I think there's a concern, depending on what they think that the Russians might be targeting, right? If they think that they're going to be trying to interfere with Starlink, that's one thing. I mean, again, it's a commercial entity, but it's a U.S. commercial entity. Or if they think they might be interfering with nuclear command and control satellites, the United States has historically been rather, you know, careful about that. You need to make sure you can keep control of your nuclear weapons and be able to send commands to them when you want to. Or if it's they're trying to interfere with exquisite billion-dollar intelligence satellites, that would be a concern as well. So I think it's important to have these conversations about, you know, what sort of activities would merit responses just so you don't have inadvertent escalation.
I want to return to the treaty you mentioned a few minutes ago. The United States and Russia have signed numerous arms control treaties, including the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 that bans nuclear weapons in space. What would it mean if Russia violated that treaty?
Well, again, that's a multilateral treaty, so many countries have signed it. It's not just between the United States and Russia. But, I mean, it would not be good if Russia were to violate it. And I think it would just be another indication of their lack of respect for international mores and, you know, rules and responsibilities. Like anything with international law, if someone violates it, I think there are consequences, but there's no global court you take them to and say, okay, here's something that they did wrong, and the global policeman's going to say there is a consequence for you. I think it's going to be more diplomatic responses, possibly even military responses if that were the case.
Victoria Sampson is the Chief Director for Space Security and Stability at the Secure World Foundation. She's based in Washington. In Somalia, there's been public outrage after three women were killed by their husbands in the span of a week. People have been in the streets demanding change. Hinda Abdi Muhammad is in the capital, Mogadishu, where she works with the Somali-based Bilan Media, a women-led news organization.
So it happened within 1 week, and two of them were pregnant. The other one was not pregnant. They were moms. They had kids. Like Lula Abdul Aziz had 5 kids, and she was pregnant when she died. And this kind of abuse was increasing in Somalia recently.
And what are the women who've been protesting in Mogadishu calling for now with regards to these murders?
So those women were fighting and also protesting because women should get, as a woman, their rights and also their justice, and also to be heard and also seeing that women know what's happening. And so if something happened to one woman, it's going to happen to other women if they don't talk about it.
So you said that these three murders in the past week or so represent an increase in domestic partner violence and murders in Somalia. How big of a problem has this been in the past?
This arising killing women is a new thing. If it was existing before, it was not like this, but this kind of now it's increasing, and Somalis, they don't know what's causing. So that's the kind of issues that we are more focusing on. What's the thing that encourages men to kill their wives, and what's happening on the families?
I understand that Balan Media is Somalia's first female news organization. Are you covering this story any differently than other news outlets?
Yeah, because covering as a women media is different from the local media that are dominated by men, usually. And Somali media is only dominated by men, most of them, or the majority. When it comes to cover this kind of stories related women issues, if that is domestic violence, if that is something that they are having challenges, we have the kind of angle that we are going to use and show the people that this kind of things are happening, what are the communities going to do about it, and also showing how women also are coming together to.
What do you hope your coverage of these murders?
It's very important for us to talk about women's issues, because when we cover those stories, it's going to reach a lot of people who are not living within Mogadishu, but it's going to reach a lot of people who live outside Mogadishu and the other regions. So when those voices are heard, it might hopefully take part of those women get their rights, and also the government can do something about it. And a lot of women might also, they see this kind of stories, they might save themselves and leave that relationship. So we are showing the people what's happening with the women and how they can care themselves.
Hinda Abdi Muhammad is acting chief editor of Balan Media, Somalia's first women-led news organization. You're listening to The World.
In Nigeria, many nurses look for jobs abroad as soon as they finish their medical training. The government there wants to make them work in Nigeria. Many believe that policy just won't address the root cause of the brain drain.
The focus should be on improving the conditions in the hospitals and healthcare centers in Nigeria so that they want to stay.
That story's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Divya Deshmukh is an international master in chess. That's the second highest title in the game. At the moment, though, she's getting a lot of attention for a recent Instagram post. In it, she says she often gets comments about her appearance rather than her playing. The 18-year-old from India said men are treated better and women should start getting equal respect. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how Deshmukh's post has ignited a discussion about sexism in competitive chess.
Netflix scored big in 2020 with the release of The Queen's Gambit.
Is there a school chess club?
What?
Is there a chess club here at the school?
The show follows Beth Harmon on her quest to become the greatest chess player in the world. It's since been hailed as one of the platform's best ever original shows.
I loved it. It made chess kind of cool, sexy, and so on.
That's Yosha Iglesias, a professional chess player and international master from France. She particularly liked that the show's main character was a woman. But having competed in chess for decades, Iglesias says one element of the show wasn't quite accurate.
The only thing I can criticize is that she basically faces no sexism or almost no sexism.
At least not nearly as much as women face today, Iglesias says. And the show was supposed to be set in the 60s.
Every time she beats a man, he's more or less a gentleman. No, this does not happen in the real world.
Iglesias is one of many women in chess who are speaking out following Divya Deshmukh's Instagram post. Jennifer Shahadi, a two-time U.S. women's chess champion, says she was happy to see such a strong message coming from a young player.
It kind of is like a statement to the next generation, like this is not going to continue. Like the chess community has to make sure that we just don't allow it.
Shahadi says she has personally experienced the same sexist treatment that Deshmukh described.
A lot of comments and my looks and my body over the years. And in tournaments that are live streamed, unless there's very intensive moderation of the comments, they often become accessible.
People have been playing chess online for a long time. But Shahadi says since the pandemic, online chess games have gotten a lot more serious.
There's not this big duality of online and live. It's all considered important and part of the game.
More online viewers means more anonymous online trolls, says Susan Ninen, a writer in southern India who has been covering chess for more than a decade.
Basically, anyone with an internet connection can key in whatever they want, you know. There'll be lots of people saying, you know, random things that, okay, you should go back to the kitchen or what do you know?
Shahadi says the false and dangerous idea that women are less intelligent than men is persistent in chess.
You will always see this at some point in these arguments about women in chess. At some point, somebody will start talking about IQ distribution.
Last year, Shahadi co-authored a New York University study on the subject. It found there's a lot of bias against women in chess, especially by people who think inherent genius is essential to being good at the game.
So if you wrap your mind around that, that means there's kind of still this boy genius myth that can infect itself into chess. And if you ascribe to that too much, that kind of leads to this place where you think that maybe women aren't as capable.
Shahadi says this sexism in chess is inherently linked to the sport's anti-transgender rules. Last year, the International Chess Federation, or FIDE, became the latest sports governing body to ban trans women from official competitions. Yosha Iglesias, who is trans, agrees that it's all shades of the same color.
Most people who are pro these anti-trans regulations basically argue that I have some form of biological advantage because women don't have the brains that men have.
Iglesias calls this logic absurd. FIDE did not respond to a request for comment on this story. Moving forward, both Iglesias and Shahadi agree that getting more women in the game is essential to combating sexism. Women make up just 10% of licensed players globally, according to the latest data, and the gap only gets wider at the top. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Nigeria, nurses are protesting new rules that will prevent them from working abroad for 2 years after completing their training. The idea makes sense for Nigeria. The government is trying to prevent a further brain drain of its medical professionals. But it is a tough sell because conditions and salaries for nurses in Nigeria are pretty bad. Aurora Almondrell has written about this for the nonprofit newsroom Type Investigations and for the Pulitzer Center. I asked her how many nurses have left Nigeria in recent years to work elsewhere.
It sounds like the latest number in the last 3 years is 42,000 nurses, which is quite considerable given that Nigeria has been struggling with their healthcare workforce for years.
The new rules would require nurses trained in Nigeria to stay there for at least 2 years before taking a job overseas. They're supposed to take effect next month. How surprised are you that Nigerian nurses are fighting back against these new rules?
Not especially. I mean, Nigerian nurses have been wanting to leave the country. And I was there in 2022 to look at the conditions that they're dealing with. And they were quite severe. You know, the lack of water, lack of basic sort of medicine and sanitation. We went to one hospital, there was no light. And this is difficult for nurses to deal with because they can't provide the care that they would like to be able to provide. In extreme cases, people are dying in their hands that shouldn't be dying because of the terrible conditions that they're having to deal with. And So when I was there, nearly everyone I talked to wanted to leave the country. There were opportunities all over the world, particularly in the UK and the US and the Middle East, to experience something different, not to be unable to provide the care that you want to do. The reason why most nurses go into the healthcare field is because they want to help people, and they can't when things are that bad in the country that they're in. So I'm not surprised that nurses are pushing back against this new rule by the Nigerian government. And in many ways, it's blaming the nurses for wanting to leave, when really the focus should be on improving the conditions in the hospitals and healthcare centers in Nigeria so that they want to stay.
The report you co-wrote with Ebonga Isine for Pulitzer, it begins with a nurse who struggled through some pretty harsh conditions during COVID, and she was certain things would get better for her due to her sacrifice. What was she expecting?
She was expecting a little bit more money. They're already being paid a fairly small amount, around $100 a month, but also not enough for their own basic living expenses. It's difficult for them to send their own children to the hospitals if they need care, for example, much less things like school, and they don't have any savings. So they were hoping that with all the pressures that they dealt with during the pandemic, they would receive some kind of recognition from the government, a little bit more money, better conditions, things like that. None of it materialized. And it sort of plunged a lot of the nurses into deeper, I would say, even despair about the conditions and the future they had within the healthcare system.
Give us a reality check. What are the salaries trained nurses from Nigeria can get in, say, the UK?
In the UK, it's around £30,000 a year.
£30,000, that's about $38,000. How does that compare to what they get in Nigeria?
Significantly more. I mean, that sounds like a lot of money if you're coming from Nigeria, where you're earning something like £12,000 a year. It's enough to live on. I've spoken as well to Nigerian nurses who have come to the UK. They feel like they're working in a much better system. Of course, the UK system also has its problems, as is the US, but it is much better than Nigeria, which is among the worst health systems in the world.
Is part of the concern that the appeal of the nursing profession in Nigeria is precisely that, to get a job outside of Nigeria? It's kind of an effective way to leave the country.
It is now, since the pandemic and during this kind of flurry to hire nurses from abroad. But in previous years, when it feels like less of an emergency in countries like the US and the UK to fill their ranks, there's far less migration. In the year prior to the pandemic, so 2018 to 2019, something like 200 or 300 nurses came from Nigeria to the UK, which has multiplied several times over. Now, the demand from places like the UK and the US is high.
There's concern that the UK and other countries are encouraging this brain drain of medical professionals from Nigeria. What's the evidence, Aurora?
For the UK, they have a lot of data. They're very vocal about wanting to increase their healthcare workforce. And a lot of that is coming from hiring abroad. You can see that in the numbers. So the 2018, before the pandemic, you're getting around 3,000 or 4,000 nurses from abroad, which has skyrocketed in 2021, 2022, and 23, including from places like Nigeria and Zimbabwe, which are red listed by the UK's own policy. They shouldn't be recruiting from there because the health systems there are too vulnerable. But the numbers keep going up. If you're paying attention to this particular space, it's hard to ignore that there's a lot of recruitment happening right now. Because of certain rules by the World Health Organization, they can't directly send recruiters to places that are on the list of vulnerable health systems like Nigeria. But having an ad on Facebook, for example, does not count as active recruitment in the country.
That's journalist Aurora Almendral, who's based in the UK, explaining new rules in Nigeria that will prohibit newly trained nurses from working abroad for 2 years.
For more than 20 years, Texas A&M has operated a campus in the Middle East. It's one of six prestigious American universities with branches in a place called Education City in Doha, Qatar. The campus brings in millions of dollars every year for Texas A&M, which is a public university. Last week, without debate or warning, the Board of Regents voted to close it. Reporter Ari Daniel considers the claims that the school's site in Doha has fallen victim to a disinformation campaign.
Brittany Bounds joined Texas A&M University at Qatar 4.5 years ago. She teaches U.S. history to an international cohort of engineering students, including many Qataris. At least half her pupils are women.
It surpassed all my expectations. There's always challenges in every university, but this one has been very near and dear to a lot of people.
But there are accusations that the Qatar government has links to terrorist groups. And yes, it's true they support Hamas. The group has a political office in Doha. Qatar sends hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Gaza, which flows through Hamas with Israel's blessing. And Qatar's played a critical role in negotiating the release of hostages in the current war between Israel and Hamas. Last week, Bounds knew that Texas A&M's Board of Regents was meeting and they'd be taking up the Qatar campus.
None of us were really worried because we knew that with the optics of everything that's happening over here in the region, we knew that they had to discuss this.
While Bounds slept, nine time zones away, the board was convening in Texas.
Next, we will consider item 5.7. Is there any discussion on this item? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
All against? No. Okay. It is approved.
In a 7-1 decision, the Board of Regents voted to phase out and then close Texas A&M in Qatar by 2028. In a press release, the board chairman said, quote, "The board has decided that the core mission of Texas A&M should be advanced primarily within Texas and the United States." Regional instability was also cited as a factor. When Brittany Bounds awoke the next morning, her phone was blowing up.
A lot of us were completely shocked. You get the news and you're just in denial. All the way up the chain, back in main campus, they had no idea that this was coming.
The Qatar Foundation was also caught off guard. They're the organization that funds 100% of Texas A&M at Qatar's operations, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars per year. Texas A&M also pockets a multi-million dollar annual management fee. Francisco Marmolejo is the president of higher education at the Qatar Foundation.
In my opinion, there is a significant misunderstanding of the ones who made the decision. In the past, in other episodes of instability in the region, the operations have continued normally.
In addition, Marmolejo says there's an outside group that's been trying to shut the Qatar campus down. He's referring to a small organization based in the U.S., the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, or ISCAP. It's issued reports asserting the country of Qatar owns the intellectual property of all research on campus, including projects with, in their words, potential military applications. Charles Asher Small is the founding director of ISCAP.
So here is Qatar, a regime that's giving a lot of money to American universities and other Western universities, using soft power to shift the discourse in academia, and as a result, to use anti-Semitism as a way to weaken the West.
The world reached out to the Board of Regents and to the leadership at Texas A&M in the U.S., but all declined to comment for this story. In remarks elsewhere, the president of Texas A&M called ISCAP's assertions a, quote, disinformation campaign. The Qatar Foundation also says the claims are baseless. Francisco Marmolejo again.
Completely nonsense. But, you know, this is part of a campaign that keeps hammering the state of Qatar and the role of Qatar Foundation. Our work is education, research, and community development.
The campus in Qatar will close by 2028. The current freshman class will be its last. Brittany Bound says that faculty and staff are concerned about their jobs. Some students feel betrayed.
Even though they may be Qatari or they may be Indian or Pakistani, they are still our representatives. And we are educating them to be good people, to make good ethical decisions, because these are all our core values for Texas A&M that we also teach here at Qatar.
For the world, I'm Ari Daniel, Beirut.
The National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine is touring the U.S. right now as the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine nears a two-year mark. Also on stage are two guest musicians, Volodymyr Vinitsky on piano and Natalia Koma on cello. They're a married couple who emigrated to the U.S. from Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union and still have close ties there. They recently performed at GBH in Boston and shared these thoughts about touring while their country is in the throes of war.
Sometimes, you know, the news are very sad. Every day when we come home after work, we come and we have dinner and we are watching news from many sources. Of course, Volodymyr speaks to his sister and we have many friends. We call them, they call us. You know, the hope is very important. We hope that still the help will come and that Ukraine will become free and our people will be liberated who are under now occupation. I think music has healing properties. For example, me and Volodymyr, we cannot live without music. Our life is dedicated to music, and music makes us happy at times. But when you are sad, you know, and you perform, it calms you down. The music, it's a means of communication. Communicate with people from all over the world without words, and it's very powerful.
That's cellist Natalia Koma with her husband Volodymyr Vinitsky on piano. They're both on the music faculty at the College of Charleston in South Carolina and touring in the U.S. with the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Ghana is caught up right now in a harsh weather system called the Harmattan. It's a season notorious for dry and dusty winds. And this year, it's brought an additional problem, a thick blanket of hazardous air over Ghana's capital, Accra. As Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports, the weather is taking a toll on the city of 4 million people.
At the University of Ghana Physics Department, environmental scientist Emmanuel Apo takes me on a tour around one of the country's air quality evaluation facilities. We climb a ladder to an elevated deck full of monitoring instruments. Air quality levels have been bad in Accra since December, and Apo says the data coming in shows the situation is not improving.
The current state of air quality is very unhealthy.
Very unhealthy?
Yes, and you have a lot of dust in the atmosphere.
Can I carry the second package for?
Which one? That big one.
This is clear outside the office of a delivery company where workers sort out packages for distribution. Dispatch rider Ifu Pascal returns from one of his rounds wearing a dusty black sweater and a helmet.
It seems the whole of last week and this week, the dust is too much.
Pascal says driving at night has become dangerous due to visibility problems. And now his health, too, is taking a hit. He says he's already been to the hospital twice in the past 2 weeks. He pulls out some medication from his pocket.
I had pains on my chest and I was coughing. That's why they gave me the antibiotics.
Yet, even now, his breathing is still not seamless and he fears his health may deteriorate. Inside the courtyard of the Fountain Basic School, school children are on break. Patience Denu, a teacher here, says the current dry weather is making some of the children sick.
Their faces all dry, their lips are breaking and all that. Because of that, they're always, like, my head, I'm feeling, they're always complaining of headache.
Denu says this makes it difficult for them to do their schoolwork.
When you are not well, quickly we have to call your parents to come for you. So sometimes they miss classes, maybe 1 or 2 days.
She says the school may shut down if the situation does not improve. And already, some hospitals are seeing a surge in cases of respiratory tract infections among children.
Respiratory tract infections. So it can be upper or lower.
At the Child Health Emergency Unit of the Kolebu Teaching Hospital in Accra, Pediatrician Dr. Frank Owusu-Setchere tries to explain to a mother why her two-year-old is coughing excessively and having breathing difficulties. Setchere tells me they are currently recording 30 cases a day, compared to previously when they saw 6 cases every 2 months.
So the children are coming with either runny nose or they are snotty, coryzal, and then they are also coughing.
In the past week, Accra's air quality has been labeled hazardous by the Ghana Meteorological Agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other air quality monitoring platforms. This places Ghana's capital alongside Delhi in India and other highly polluted cities worldwide.
From our monitoring locations along the roadside, we realize that the pollution levels are high.
That's Selina Amwa, head of environmental quality at the EPA. She explains that climate change is causing desert areas to expand, which has increased the source of dust carried by the Harmattan winds. Amwa says extreme weather events, like intense windstorms, have blown in unusually large amounts of dust particles.
The only thing we can do is to take precautions to stay safe. So if there is no need for you to go out, you don't go out, you stay indoors.
And if you must go out, you need to mask up, she says. Dirty air is the world's biggest environmental killer, responsible for more than 4 million deaths annually. In Ghana, this translates to at least 28,000 premature deaths every year. Yet, just 1% of global development aid is spent on tackling air pollution. The World Health Organization says it is concerned that the ongoing extreme weather events in the country may worsen these statistics unless pollution and climate change are addressed collaboratively. Akosua Kwache is with the WHO office in Ghana.
The health effects of climate change, there is evidence to indicate that issues like respiratory infections, cardiovascular diseases, even some cancers are attributable to effects of climate change.
Experts say Ghana should begin to embrace green initiatives like investing more in cleaner energy and tree planting, which can significantly improve and sustain the country's air quality. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
On Tuesday night, Rio de Janeiro enjoyed the last raucous moments of carnival before the start of the religious observance of Lent. The city was throbbing with color and music. Samba schools from different Rio neighborhoods brought out their best musicians and dancers and singers for a blowout parade and competition. This year's winner, the Virodoru Samba School.
You have to visualize this. 24 percussionists wearing white and red, marching and playing the rhythms that propel the crowds down the street. And then the dancers in their gravity-defying costumes with feathers and sequins and hot fluorescent reds, yellows, silver, and gold. Not to mention the seductive grace of a lot of skin and muscle moving and grooving to the percussion.
And here comes the float, a 30-foot orange and yellow snake with a giant bobbing dragon's head. On top, on the neck of the serpent, a fierce dancer with a voluminous afro, a sequined bodysuit, and gold high-heeled sandals. She is the serpent goddess straight out of Benin, formerly Dahomey. Many people from that part of West Africa were enslaved and brought to Brazil.
It's a story that the Virodoru Samba School worked into the song that was part of their performance in Carnival this year. Here it is in the group's official video. Samba, the sound that drives Carnival, is music that came out of the experience of enslaved Africans, whose descendants now make up nearly 60% of Brazil's 200 million people.
The lyrics to Virodoru's song explain that this snake's nest is ready to fight. Red-hot loyalty, they say, fire in the form of a woman, an uprising to freedom, divinity in Dahomey. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening, as always.